This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents The Reason for God, written and read by Timothy Keller. Introduction. The enemies are both right. There is a great gulf today between what is popularly known as liberalism and conservatism. Each side demands that you not only disagree with, but disdain the other, as at best, crazy, or at worst, evil. This is particularly true when religion is the point at issue. Progressives cry out that fundamentalism is growing rapidly and non-belief is stigmatized. They point out that politics has turned toward the right, supported by megachurches and mobilized Orthodox believers. Conservatives endlessly denounce what they see as an increasingly skeptical and relativistic society. Major universities, media companies, and elite institutions are heavily secular, they say, and they control the culture. Which is it? Is skepticism or faith on the ascendancy in the world today? The answer is yes. The enemies are both right. Skepticism, fear, and anger toward traditional religion are growing in power and influence. But at the same time, robust Orthodox belief in the traditional faiths is growing as well. The non-church-going population in the United States and Europe is steadily increasing. The number of Americans answering no religious preference to poll questions has skyrocketed, having doubled or even tripled in the last decade. A century ago, most U.S. universities shifted from a formally Christian foundation to an overtly secular one. As a result, those with traditional religious beliefs have little foothold in any of the institutions of cultural power. But even as more and more people identify themselves as having no religious preference, certain churches with supposedly obsolete beliefs in an infallible Bible and miracles are growing in the United States and exploding in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Even in much of Europe, there is some growth in church attendance. And despite the secularism of most universities and colleges, religious faith is growing in some corners of academia. It is estimated that 10 to 25% of all the teachers and professors of philosophy in the country are Orthodox Christians, up from less than 1% just 30 years ago. Prominent academic Stanley Fish may have had an eye on that trend when he reported, "When Jacques Derrida died in November 2004, I was called by a reporter who wanted to know what would succeed high theory and the triumvirate of race, gender, and class as the center of intellectual energy in the academy. I answered like a shot, religion." In short, the world is polarizing over religion. It is getting both more religious and less religious at the same time. There was once a confident belief that secular European countries were the harbingers for the rest of the world. Religion, it was thought, would thin out from its more robust supernaturalist forms or die out altogether. But the theory that technological advancement brings inevitable secularization is now being scrapped or radically rethought. Even Europe may not face a secular future, with Christianity growing modestly and Islam growing exponentially. I speak from an unusual vantage point on this two-edged phenomenon. I was raised in a mainline Lutheran church in eastern Pennsylvania. When I reached my teens in the early 1960s, the time came for me to attend confirmation class, a two-year course that covered Christian beliefs, practices, and history. Its aim was to bring young people into a fuller understanding of the faith so they could publicly commit to it. My teacher for the first year was a retired minister. He was quite traditional and conservative, speaking often of the danger of hell and the need for great faith. In the second year of the course, however, the instructor was a new young cleric just out of seminary. He was a social activist and was filled with deep doubts about traditional Christian doctrine. It was almost like being instructed in two different religions. In the first year, we stood before a holy, just God, whose wrath could only be turned aside at great effort and cost. In the second year, we heard of a spirit of love in the universe, who mainly required that we work for human rights and the liberation of the oppressed. The main question I wanted to ask our instructors was, which one of you is lying? But 14-year-olds are not so bold, and I just kept my mouth shut. My family later found its way to a more conservative church in a small Methodist denomination. For several years, this strengthened what could be called the hellfire layer of my religious formation, although the pastor and people there were personally as gentle as could be. Then I went off to college, to one of those fine liberal smaller universities in the Northeast. I majored in history, which quickly began to throw water on the hellfire in my imagination. The history and philosophy departments were socially radicalized and were heavily influenced by the neo-Marxist critical theory of the Frankfurt School. In 1968, this was heady stuff. The social activism was particularly attractive, and the critique of American bourgeois society was compelling, but its philosophical underpinnings were confusing to me. I seemed to see two camps before me, and there was something radically wrong with both of them. The people most passionate about social justice were moral relativists, and the morally upright didn't seem to care about the oppression going on all over the world. I was emotionally drawn to the former path, what young person wouldn't be. Liberate the oppressed and sleep with who you wanted. But I kept asking the question, if morality is relative, why isn't social justice as well? This seemed to be a blatant inconsistency in my professors and their followers, yet now I saw the stark contradiction in the traditional churches. How could I turn back to the kind of Orthodox Christianity that supported segregation in the South and apartheid in South Africa? Christianity began to seem very unreal to me, though I was unable to discern a viable alternative way of life and thought. I didn't know it at the time, but this spiritual unreality stemmed from three barriers that lay across my path. During my college years, these three barriers eroded, and my faith became vital and life-affecting. The first barrier was an intellectual one. I was confronted with a host of tough questions about Christianity. What about other religions? What about evil and suffering? How could a loving God judge and punish? Why believe anything at all? I began to read books and arguments on both sides of these issues, and slowly but surely, Christianity began to make more and more sense. The rest of this book lays out why I still think so. The second barrier was an interior personal one. As a child, the plausibility of a faith can rest on the authority of others. But when we reach adulthood, there is need for personal, first-hand experience as well. While I had said my prayers for years, and while I sometimes had that inspirational aesthetic sense of wonder at the sight of a sea or mountain, I had never experienced God's presence personally. This required not so much knowledge of techniques for prayer, but a process in which I came to grips with my own needs, flaws, and problems. It was painful and was, as is typical, triggered by disappointments and failures. It would take another different kind of book to go into them. But it needs to be said that faith journeys are never simply intellectual exercises. The third barrier was a social one. I desperately needed to find a third camp, a group of Christians who had a concern for justice in the world, but who grounded it in the nature of God rather than in their own subjective feelings. When I found that band of brothers and sisters, just as important, things began to change for me. These three barriers did not come down quickly or in any set order. Rather, they were completely intertwined and dependent on one another. I did not work through them in any methodical way. It's only in hindsight that I see how the three factors work together. Because I was always looking for that third camp, I became interested in shaping and initiating new Christian communities. That meant the ministry, so I entered it just a few years after college. In the late 1980s, my wife Kathy and I moved to Manhattan with our three young sons to begin a new church for a largely non-church-going population. During the research phase, I was told by almost everyone that it was a fool's errand. Church meant moderate or conservative. The city was liberal and edgy. Church meant families. New York City was filled with young singles and non-traditional households. Church most of all meant belief. But Manhattan was the land of skeptics, critics, and cynics. The middle class, the conventional market for a church, was fleeing the city because of crime and rising costs. That left the sophisticated and the hip, the wealthy and the poor. Most of these people just laugh at the idea of church, I was told. Congregations in the city were dwindling, most struggling to even maintain their buildings. Many of my early contacts said that the few congregations that had maintained a following had done so by adapting traditional Christian teaching to the more pluralistic ethos of the city. Don't tell people they have to believe in Jesus. That's considered narrow-minded here. They were incredulous when I explained that the beliefs of the new church would be the orthodox, historic tenets of Christianity. The infallibility of the Bible, the deity of Christ, the necessity of spiritual regeneration, the new birth. All doctrines considered hopelessly dated by the majority of New Yorkers. Nobody ever said, forget about it, out loud, but it always hung in the air. Nevertheless, we launched Redeemer Presbyterian Church, and by the end of 2007, it had grown to more than 5,000 attendees and had spawned more than a dozen daughter congregations in the immediate metropolitan area. The church is quite multi-ethnic and young, average age about 30, and is more than two-thirds single. Meanwhile, dozens of other similarly Orthodox-believing congregations have sprung up in Manhattan and hundreds of others throughout the four other boroughs. One survey showed that in the last several years, more than 100 churches had been started in New York City by Christians from Africa alone. We were as stunned by this as anyone. New York isn't alone. In the fall of 2006, The Economist ran a story with the subtitle, "Christianity is Collapsing Everywhere But London." The crux of the article was that despite the fact that church attendance and profession of the Christian faith was plummeting across Britain and Europe, many young professionals and new immigrants in London were flocking to evangelical churches. That is exactly what I've seen here. This leads to a strange conclusion. We have come to a cultural moment in which both skeptics and believers feel their existence is threatened because both secular skepticism and religious faith are on the rise in significant, powerful ways. We have neither the Western Christendom of the past, nor the secular religionless society that was predicted for the future. We have something else entirely. How can we find a way forward? First, each side should accept that both religious belief and skepticism are on the rise. Atheist author Sam Harris and religious right leader Pat Robertson should each admit the fact that his particular tribe is strong and increasing in influence. This would eliminate the self-talk that is rampant in each camp, namely that it will soon be extinct, overrun by the opposition. Nothing like that is imminently possible. If we stop saying such things to ourselves, it might make everyone more civil and generous toward opposing views. Such an admission is not only reassuring, but also humbling. There are still many of a secular turn of mind who confidently say Orthodox faith is vainly trying to resist the tide of history, though there's no historical evidence that religion is dying out at all. Religious believers should also be much less dismissive of secular skepticism. Christians should reflect on the fact that such large sectors of our formerly largely Christian societies have turned their backs on faith. Surely that should lead to self-examination. The time for making elegant dismissive gestures toward the other side is past. Something more is now required. But what? I want to make a proposal that I have seen bear much fruit in the lives of young New Yorkers over the years. I recommend that each side look at doubt in a radically new way. Let's begin with believers. A faith without some doubts is like a human body without any antibodies in it. People who blithely go through life too busy or indifferent to ask hard questions about why they believe as they do will find themselves defenseless against either the experience of tragedy or the probing questions of a smart skeptic. A person's faith can collapse almost overnight if she has failed over the years to patiently listen to her own doubts, which should only be discarded after long reflection. Believers should acknowledge and wrestle with doubts, not only their own, but their friends and neighbors. It is no longer sufficient to hold beliefs just because you inherited them. Only if you struggle long and hard with objections to your faith will you be able to provide grounds for your beliefs to skeptics, including yourself, that are plausible rather than ridiculous or offensive. And just as important for our current situation, such a process will lead you, even after you come to a position of strong faith, to respect and understand those who doubt. But even as believers should learn to look for reasons behind their faith, skeptics must learn to look for a type of faith hidden within their reasoning. All doubts, however skeptical and cynical they may seem, are really a set of alternate beliefs. You cannot doubt belief A except from a position of faith in belief B. For example, if you doubt Christianity because you object, there can't be just one true religion, you must recognize that this statement is itself an act of faith. No one can prove it empirically, and it is not a universal truth that everyone accepts. If you went to the Middle East and said, there can't be just one true religion, nearly everyone would say, why not? The reason you doubt Christianity's belief A is because you hold unprovable belief B. Every doubt, therefore, is based on a leap of faith. Some will respond to all this, my doubts are not based on a leap of faith. I have no beliefs about God one way or another. I simply feel no need for God, and I'm not interested in thinking about it. But hidden beneath this feeling is the very modern American belief that the existence of God is a matter of indifference unless it intersects with my emotional needs. The speaker is betting his or her life that no God exists who would hold you accountable for your beliefs and behavior if you didn't feel the need for him. That may be true, or it may not be true. But again, it is quite a leap of faith. The only way to doubt Christianity rightly and fairly is to discern the alternate belief under each of your doubts and then to ask yourself what reasons you have for believing it. How do you know your belief is true? It would be inconsistent to require more justification for Christian belief than you do for your own, but that is frequently what happens. In fairness, you must doubt your doubts. My thesis is that if you come to recognize the beliefs on which your doubts about Christianity are based, and if you seek as much proof for those beliefs as you seek from Christians for theirs, you will discover that your doubts are not so solid as they first appeared. I commend two processes to my readers. I urge skeptics to wrestle with the unexamined blind faith on which skepticism is based and to see how hard it is to justify those beliefs to those who do not share them. I also urge believers to wrestle with their personal and culture's objections to the faith. At the end of each process, even if you remain the skeptic or believer you have been, you will hold your own position with both greater clarity and greater humility. Then there will be an understanding, sympathy, and respect for the other side that did not exist before. Believers and non-believers will then rise to the level of disagreement rather than simply denouncing one another. This happens when each side has learned to represent the other's argument in its strongest and most positive form. Only then is it safe and fair to disagree with it. This will achieve civility in a pluralistic society, which is no small thing. The rest of this audiobook is a distillation of the many conversations I've had with doubters over the years. In both my preaching and personal interactions, I've tried to respectfully help skeptics look at their own faith foundations, while at the same time laying bare my own to their strongest criticisms. In the first half of this volume, we will review the seven biggest objections and doubts about Christianity I've heard from people over the years. I will respectfully discern the alternate beliefs beneath each of them. Then in the second half of the book, we will examine the reasons underlying Christian beliefs. Respectful dialogue between entrenched traditional conservative and secular liberal people is a very great good, and I hope this book will promote it. But my experience as a pastor in New York has given me another incentive to write this volume. As soon as I arrived in New York, I realized that the faith and doubt situation was not what the experts thought it was. Older white people who ran the cultural business of the city were definitely quite secular. But among the increasingly multi-ethnic younger professionals and the working-class immigrants, there was a lush, category-defying variety of strong religious beliefs. And Christianity in particular was growing rapidly among them. I think these younger Christians are the vanguard of some major new religious, social, and political arrangements that could make the older forms of culture wars obsolete. After they wrestle with doubts and objections to Christianity, many come out on the other side with an Orthodox faith that doesn't fit the current categories of liberal Democrat or conservative Republican. Many see both sides in the culture war making individual freedom and personal happiness the ultimate value rather than God and the common good. Liberals' individualism comes out in their views of abortion, sex, and marriage. Conservatives' individualism comes out in their deep distrust of the public sector and in their understanding of poverty as a failure of personal responsibility. The new, fast-spreading multi-ethnic Orthodox Christianity in the cities is much more concerned about the poor and social justice than Republicans have been, and at the same time much more concerned about upholding classic Christian moral and sexual ethics than Democrats have been. While the first half of the audiobook lays out a pathway that many of these Christians have taken through doubt, the second half of the audiobook is a more positive exposition of the faith they are living out in the world. Here are three people in the church now. June was a graduate of an Ivy League university living and working in Manhattan. She became so obsessed with her physical image that she developed eating disorders and substance addictions. She came to see that she was heading for self-destruction, but she also realized that she had no particular reason to stop being reckless with her life. After all, what did her life mean? Why not be self-destructive? She turned to church and sought an understanding of God's mercy and an experience of His reality. She saw a counselor at the church who helped her draw a connection between the mercy of God and her seemingly inexhaustible need for acceptance. Finally, she had the confidence to seek an encounter with God Himself. Though she can't pinpoint one moment, she came to feel for the first time unconditionally loved as a true daughter of God. Gradually, she received freedom from her self-destructive behavior. Jeffrey was a New York City musician raised in a conservative Jewish home. Both his father and mother suffered terribly with cancer, his mother succumbing to it. Because of a variety of physical ailments from his youth, he took up the practice of Chinese healing arts along with Taoist and Buddhist meditation, and became extremely focused on physical wellness. He was in no state of spiritual need when a friend began taking him to Redeemer. He liked the sermons until that Jesus business came around at the end, at which point he'd stop listening. Soon, however, he became somewhat jealous of his Christian friend's joy and hope for the future that he had not encountered before. Then he began listening to the ends of the sermons and realizing they posed an intellectual challenge that he had not wanted to face. Finally, to his surprise, during his times of meditation, he discovered his moments of normally pure quiet and stillness were constantly interrupted by visions of Jesus on the cross. He began to pray to the Christian God, and soon he realized that his dominant life narrative had been the escape and total avoidance of suffering. Now he saw how futile such a life goal was. When he understood that Jesus had surrendered his physical health and life to save the world and him, it moved him deeply. He saw a way to get the courage to face the inevitable suffering of the future and to know there would be a path through it. He embraced the gospel of Jesus Christ. Kelly was an Ivy League atheist. As a 12-year-old, Kelly watched her grandfather die of cancer and her 2-year-old sister undergo surgery, chemo, and radiation therapy for a brain tumor. By the time she was an undergraduate at Columbia University, she had lost hope that life had any meaning to it. Several of her Christian friends at college spoke to her of their faith, but she was rocky soil for the seeds of their testimonies. However, when her sister had a stroke and was paralyzed at the age of 14, it moved her not to give up on God, but to begin more deliberate searching. By then she was living and working in the city. She met her future husband, Kevin, also a Columbia grad and an atheist, now working on Wall Street with J.P. Morgan. Their doubts about God were very stubborn, and yet they had doubts about their doubts, and so they began attending Redeemer. Their pilgrimage toward faith was slow and painstaking. One of the things that kept them on the trail, however, was the large number of believing Christians they met that were every bit as sophisticated and smart as anyone else they'd met in the city. Finally, they were not only convinced of Christianity's intellectual credibility, but were attracted by its vision for life. Kelly wrote, "As an atheist, I thought I lived a moral, community-oriented, concerned with social justice kind of life, but Christianity had an even higher standard, down to our thoughts and the state of our hearts. I accepted God's forgiveness and invited Him into my life." Kevin wrote, "While sitting in a coffee shop reading C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, I put down the book and wrote in my notebook, 'The evidence surrounding the claims of Christianity is simply overwhelming. I realize that my achievements were ultimately unsatisfying, the approval of man is fleeting, that a carpe diem life lived solely for adventure is just a form of narcissism and idolatry. And so, I became a believer in Christ." Kelly's account recalls how, as a struggler with doubt and faith, the passage about Thomas in the New Testament was a comfort to her. There, Jesus modeled a view of doubt more nuanced than those of either modern skeptics or modern believers. When Jesus confronted doubting Thomas, he challenged him not to acquiesce in doubt, believe, and yet responded to his request for more evidence. In another incident, Jesus meets a man who confesses that he is filled with doubts, who says to Jesus, "Help thou my unbelief. Help me with my doubts." In response to this honest admission, Jesus blesses him and heals his son. Whether you consider yourself a believer or a skeptic, I invite you to seek the same kind of honesty and to grow in an understanding of the nature of your own doubts. The result will exceed anything you can imagine. Part 1. The Leap of Doubt. Chapter 1. There can't be just one true religion. During my nearly 2 decades in New York City, I've had numerous opportunities to ask people, what is your biggest problem with Christianity? What troubles you the most about its beliefs or how it is practiced? One of the most frequent answers I have heard over the years can be summed up in one word, exclusivity. I was once invited to be the Christian representative in a panel discussion at a local college, along with a Jewish rabbi and a Muslim imam. The panelists were asked to discuss the differences among religions. The conversation was courteous, intelligent, and respectful in tone. Each speaker affirmed that there were significant irreconcilable differences between the major faiths. A case in point was the person of Jesus. We all agreed on this statement. If Christians are right about Jesus being God, then Muslims and Jews fail in a serious way to love God as God really is. But if Muslims and Jews are right that Jesus is not God, but rather a teacher or prophet, then Christians fail in a serious way to love God as He really is. The bottom line was, we couldn't all be equally right about the nature of God. Several of the students were quite disturbed by this. One student insisted that what mattered was to believe in God and to be a loving person yourself. To insist that one faith has a better grasp of the truth than others was intolerant. Another student looked at us clerics and said in his frustration, "We will never come to know peace on earth if religious leaders keep on making such exclusive claims." It's widely believed that one of the main barriers to world peace is religion, and especially the major traditional religions with their exclusive claims to superiority. It may surprise you that though I am a Christian minister, I agree with this. Religion, generally speaking, tends to create a slippery slope in the heart. Each religion informs its followers that they have the truth, and this naturally leads them to feel superior to those with differing beliefs. Also, a religion tells its followers that they are saved and connected to God by devotedly performing that truth. This moves them to separate from those who are less devoted and pure in life. Therefore, it is easy for one religious group to stereotype and caricature other ones. Once this situation exists, it can easily spiral down into the marginalization of others or even to acts of oppression, abuse, or violence against them. Once we recognize how religion erodes peace on earth, what can we do about it? There are three approaches that civic and cultural leaders around the world are using to address the divisiveness of religion. There are calls to outlaw religion, condemn religion, or at least to radically privatize it. Many people are investing great hope in them. Unfortunately, I don't believe any of them will be effective. Indeed, I'm afraid they will only aggravate the situation. Number one, outlaw religion. One way to deal with the divisiveness of religion has been to control or even forbid it with a heavy hand. There have been several massive efforts to do this in the 20th century. Soviet Russia, Communist China, the Khmer Rouge, and, in a different way, Nazi Germany, were all determined to tightly control religious practice in an effort to stop it from dividing society or eroding the power of the state. The result, however, was not more peace and harmony, but more oppression. Going hand in hand with such efforts was a widespread belief in the late 19th and early 20th century that religion would weaken and die out as the human race became more technologically advanced. This view saw religion as playing a role in human evolution. We once needed religion to help us cope with a very frightening, incomprehensible world. But as we become more scientifically sophisticated and more able to understand and control our own environment, our need for religion would diminish, it was believed. But this has not happened, and this secularization thesis is now largely discredited. Virtually all major religions are growing in number of adherents. Christianity's growth, especially in the developing world, has been explosive. There are now 6 times more Anglicans in Nigeria alone than there are in all of the United States. There are more Presbyterians in Ghana than in the United States and Scotland combined. Korea has gone from 1% to 50% Christian in 100 years, and experts believe the same thing is going to happen in China. Because of the vitality of religious faith in the world, efforts to suppress or control it often serve only to make it stronger. When the Chinese communists expelled Western missionaries after World War II, they thought they were killing off Christianity in China. Instead, this move only served to make the leadership of the Chinese church more indigenous and therefore to strengthen it. Religion is not just a temporary thing that helped us adapt to our environment. Rather, it is a permanent and central aspect of the human condition. This is a bitter pill for secular non-religious people to swallow. Everyone wants to think that they are in the mainstream, that they are not extremists. But robust religious beliefs dominate the world. There is no reason to expect that to change. Number two, condemn religion. Religion is not going away, and its power cannot be diminished by government control. But can't we, via education and argument, find ways to socially discourage religions that claim to have the truth and that try to convert others to their beliefs? Couldn't we find ways to urge all of our citizens, whatever their religious beliefs, to admit that each religion or faith is just one of many equally valid paths to God and ways to live in the world? This approach creates an environment in which it is considered unenlightened and outrageous to make exclusive religious claims, even in personal conversations. It does so by stating and restating certain axioms that eventually achieve the status of common sense. Those who deviate from them are stigmatized as foolish or dangerous. Unlike the first strategy, this approach to the divisiveness of religion is having some effect. It cannot ultimately succeed, however, because at its heart is a fatal inconsistency, even perhaps a hypocrisy, that will eventually lead to the collapse of this way of thinking. What follows are several of these axioms and the problems with each. All major religions are equally valid and basically teach the same thing. This assertion is so common that one journalist recently wrote that anyone who believed that there are inferior religions is a right-wing extremist. Do we really want to say that the Branch Davidians or religions requiring child sacrifice are not inferior to any other faith? The great majority of people would almost certainly agree that they are. Most people who assert the equality of religions have in mind the major world faiths, not splinter sects. This was the form of the objection I got from the student the night I was on the panel. He contended that doctrinal differences between Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, and Hinduism were superficial and insignificant, that they all believed in the same God. But when I asked him who that God was, he described him as an all-loving spirit in the universe. The problem with this position is its inconsistency. It insists that doctrine is unimportant, but at the same time assumes doctrinal beliefs about the nature of God that are at loggerheads with those of all the major faiths. Buddhism doesn't believe in a God at all. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam believe in a God who holds people accountable for their beliefs and practices, and whose attributes could not be all reduced to love. Ironically, the insistence that doctrines do not matter is really a doctrine itself. It holds a specific view of God, which is touted as superior and more enlightened than the beliefs of most major religions. So the proponents of this view do the very thing they forbid in others. Each religion sees part of the spiritual truth, but none can see the whole truth. Sometimes this point is illustrated with the story of the blind man and the elephant. Several blind men were walking along and came upon an elephant that allowed them to touch and feel it. "This creature is long and flexible like a snake," said the first blind man, holding the elephant's trunk. "Not at all. It is thick and round like a tree trunk," said the second blind man, feeling the elephant's leg. "No, it is large and flat," said the third blind man, touching the elephant's side. Each blind man could only feel part of the elephant. None could see the entire elephant. In the same way, it is argued, the religions of the world each have a grasp on part of the truth about spiritual reality, but none can see the whole elephant or claim to have a comprehensive view of the truth. This illustration backfires on its users. The story is told from the point of view of someone who is not blind. How could you know that each blind man only sees part of the elephant unless you claim to be able to see the whole elephant? Leslie Newbegin, a British theologian, writes, "There is an appearance of humility in the protestation that the truth is much greater than any one of us can grasp. But if this is used to invalidate all claims to discern the truth, it is in fact an arrogant claim to a kind of knowledge which is superior to all others. We have to ask, what is the absolute vantage ground from which you claim to be able to relativize all the absolute claims these different scriptures make? How could you possibly know that no religion can see the whole truth unless you yourself have the superior, comprehensive knowledge of spiritual reality you just claimed that none of the religions have? Religious belief is too culturally and historically conditioned to be truth. When I first came to New York City nearly 20 years ago, I more often heard the objection that all religions are equally true. Now, however, I'm more likely to be told that all religions are equally false. The objection goes like this. All moral and spiritual claims are the product of our particular historical and cultural moment, and therefore, no one should claim they can know the truth, since no one can judge whether one assertion about spiritual and moral reality is truer than another. The sociologist Peter Berger reveals the serious inconsistency in this common assumption. In his book, A Rumor of Angels, Berger recounts how the 20th century had uncovered the sociology of knowledge, namely, that people believe what they do largely because they are socially conditioned to do so. We like to think that we think for ourselves, but it is not that simple. We think like the people we most admire and need. Everyone belongs to a community that reinforces the plausibility of some beliefs and discourages others. Berger notes that many have concluded from this fact that, because we are all locked into our historical and cultural locations, it is impossible to judge the rightness or wrongness of competing beliefs. Berger goes on, however, to point out that absolute relativism can only exist if the relativists exempt themselves from their own razor. If you infer from the social conditionedness of all belief that no belief can be held as universally true for everyone, that itself is a comprehensive claim about everyone that is the product of social conditions, so it cannot be true on its own terms. Relativity relativizes itself, says Berger, so we can't have relativism all the way down. Our cultural biases make weighing competing truth claims harder, yes. The social conditionedness of all belief is a fact. But it cannot be used to argue that all truth is completely relative, or else the very argument refutes itself. Berger concludes that we cannot avoid weighing spiritual and religious claims by hiding behind the cliché that there's no way to know the truth. We must still do the hard work of asking which affirmations about God, human nature, and spiritual reality are true and which are false. We will have to base our life on some answer to that question. So you can't say all claims about religion are historically conditioned except the one I am making right now. If you insist that no one can determine which beliefs are right and wrong, why should we believe what you are saying? The reality is that we all make truth claims of some sort, and it is very hard to weigh them responsibly, but we have no alternative but to try to do so. It is arrogant to insist your religion is right and to convert others to it. The noted religion scholar John Hick has written that once you become aware that there are many other equally intelligent and good people in the world who hold different beliefs from you, and that you will not be able to convince them otherwise, then it is arrogant for you to continue to try to convert them or to hold your view to be the superior truth. Once again, there is an inherent contradiction. Most people in the world don't hold to John Hick's view that all religions are equally valid, and many of them are equally as good and intelligent as he is, and unlikely to change their views. That would make the statement, all religious claims to have a better view of things are arrogant and wrong, to be, on its own terms, arrogant and wrong. Many say that it is ethnocentric to claim that our religion is superior to others. Yet isn't that very statement ethnocentric? Most non-Western cultures have no problem saying that their culture and religion is best. The idea that it is wrong to do so is deeply rooted in Western traditions of self-criticism and individualism. To charge others with the sin of ethnocentrism is really a way of saying our culture's approach to other cultures is superior to yours. We are then doing the very thing we forbid others to do. The historian C. John Somerville has pointed out that a religion can be judged only on the basis of another religion. You can't evaluate a religion except on the basis of some ethical criteria that, in the end, amount to your own religious stance. By now, the fatal flaw in this approach to religion in general and to Christianity in particular should be obvious. Skeptics believe that any exclusive claims to a superior knowledge of spiritual reality cannot be true, but this objection is itself a religious belief. It assumes God is unknowable, or that God is loving but not wrathful, or that God is an impersonal force rather than a person who speaks in Scripture. All of these are unprovable faith assumptions. In addition, their proponents believe they have a superior way to view things. They believe the world will be a better place if everyone dropped the traditional religion's view of God and truth and adopted theirs. Therefore, their view is also an exclusive claim about the nature of spiritual reality. If all such views are to be discouraged, this one should be as well. If it is not narrow to hold this view, then there is nothing inherently narrow about holding to traditional religious beliefs. Indeed, it is no more narrow to claim that one religion is right than to claim that one way to think about all religions, namely that all are equal, is right. We are all exclusive in our beliefs about religion, but in different ways. Number 3, keep religion completely private. A complementary approach to the divisiveness of religion is to allow that people may privately believe their faith is the truth and may evangelize for their faith, but that religious beliefs should be kept out of the public sphere. Influential thinkers such as John Rawls and Robert Audi have argued that in public political discussions, we may not argue for a moral position unless it has a secular, non-religious grounding. Rawls is well known for insisting that what he calls comprehensive religious views be excluded from public discourse. Recently, a large array of scientists and philosophers signed a Declaration in Defense of Science and Secularism, which called on the leaders of our government to not permit legislation or executive action to be influenced by religious beliefs. The signers included Peter Singer, E.O. Wilson, and Daniel C. Dennett. The philosopher Richard Rorty, for example, has argued that religious faith must remain a strictly private affair and must never be brought into discussions of public policy. To ever use an argument grounded in a religious belief is simply a conversation stopper which the non-believer cannot engage. To those who complain that this approach discriminates against religion, Rorty and others retort that this policy is simply pragmatic. They are not ideologically opposed to religion per se, nor are they seeking to control religious beliefs, so long as they are kept in the private sphere. However, in the public square, it is divisive and time-consuming to argue constantly over religion. Religion-based positions are seen as sectarian and controversial, while secular reasoning for moral positions are seen as universal and available to all. Therefore, public discourse should be secular, never religious. Without reference to any divine revelation or confessional tradition, we should work together on the great problems of our time, such as AIDS, poverty, education, and so on. We should keep our religious views to ourselves and unite around policies that work best for the most people. Stephen L. Carter of Yale responds that it is impossible to leave religious views behind when we do any kind of moral reasoning at all. He writes, "Efforts to craft a public square from which religious conversation is absent, no matter how thoughtfully worked out, will always in the end say to those of organized religion that they alone, unlike everybody else, must enter a public dialogue only after leaving behind that part of themselves that they consider the most vital." How can Carter make such a claim? Let's begin by asking what religion is. Some say it is a form of belief in God. But that would not fit Zen Buddhism, which does not really believe in God at all. Some say it is belief in the supernatural, but that does not fit Hinduism, which does not believe in a supernatural realm beyond the material world, but only a spiritual reality within the empirical. What is religion, then? It is a set of beliefs that explain what life is all about, who we are, and the most important things that human beings should spend their time doing. For example, some think that this material world is all there is, that we are here by accident, and when we die, we just rot. And therefore, the important thing is to choose to do what makes you happy and not let others impose their beliefs on you. Notice that though this is not an explicit organized religion, it contains a master narrative, an account about the meaning of life, along with a recommendation for how to live based on that account of things. Some call this a worldview, while others call it a narrative identity. In either case, it is a set of faith assumptions about the nature of things. It is an implicit religion. Broadly understood, faith in some view of the world and human nature informs everyone's life. Everyone lives and operates out of some narrative identity, whether it is thought out and reflected upon or not. All who say, "You ought to do this," or "You shouldn't do that," reason out of such an implicit moral and religious position. Pragmatists say that we should leave our deeper worldviews behind and find consensus about what works. But our view of what works is determined by, to use a Wendell Berry title, what we think people are for. Any picture of happy human life that works is necessarily informed by deep-seated beliefs about the purpose of human life. Even the most secular pragmatists come to the table with deep commitments and narrative accounts of what it means to be human. Rorty insists that religion-based beliefs are conversation stoppers, but all of our most fundamental convictions about things are beliefs that are nearly impossible to justify to those who don't share them. Secular concepts such as self-realization and autonomy are impossible to prove and conversation stoppers just as much as appeals to the Bible. Statements that seem to be common sense to the speakers are nonetheless often profoundly religious in nature. Imagine that Ms. A. argues that all the safety nets for the poor should be removed in the name of survival of the fittest. Ms. B. might respond, "The poor have a right to a decent standard of living. They are human beings like the rest of us." Ms. A. could then come back with the fact that many bioethicists today think the concept of human is artificial and impossible to define. She might continue that there is no possibility of treating all living organisms as ends rather than means, and that some always have to die that others may live. That is simply the way nature works. If Ms. B. counters with a pragmatic argument that we should help the poor simply because it makes society work better, Ms. A. could come up with many similar pragmatic arguments about why letting some of the poor just die would be even more efficient. Now Ms. B. would be getting angry. She would respond heatedly that starving the poor is simply unethical. But Ms. A. would retort, "Who says ethics must be the same for everyone?" Ms. B. would finally exclaim, "I wouldn't want to live in a society like the one you are describing." In this interchange, Ms. B. has tried to follow John Rawls and find universally accessible, neutral, and objective arguments that would convince everyone that we must not starve the poor. She has failed, because there are none. In the end, Ms. B. affirms the equality and dignity of human individuals simply because she believes it is true and right. She takes an article of faith that people are more valuable than rocks or trees, though she can't prove such a belief scientifically. Her public policy proposals are ultimately based on a religious stance. This leads a legal theorist, Michael J. Perry, to conclude that it is quixotic in any event to attempt to construct an airtight barrier between religiously grounded moral discourse and secular discourse in public political argument. Rorty and others argue that religious argument is too controversial, but Perry retorts in Under God, Religious Faith and Liberal Democracy, that secular grounds for moral positions are no less controversial than religious grounds, and a very strong case can be made that all moral positions are at least implicitly religious. Ironically, insisting that religious reasoning be excluded from the public square is itself a controversial, sectarian point of view. When you come out into the public square, it is impossible to leave your convictions about ultimate values behind. Let's take marriage and divorce laws as a case study. Is it possible to craft laws that we all agree work apart from particular worldview commitments? I don't believe so. Your views of what is right will be based on what you think the purpose of marriage is. If you think marriage is mainly for the rearing of children to benefit the whole society, then you will make divorce very difficult. If you think the purpose of marriage is more primarily for the happiness and emotional fulfillment of the adults who enter it, you will make divorce much easier. The former view is grounded in a view of human flourishing and well-being in which the family is more important than the individual, as is seen in the moral traditions of Confucianism, Judaism, and Christianity. The latter approach is a more individualistic view of human nature based on the Enlightenment's understanding of things. The divorce laws you think work will depend on prior beliefs about what it means to be happy and fully human. There is no objective, universal consensus about what that is. Although many continue to call for the exclusion of religious views from the public square, increasing numbers of thinkers, both religious and secular, are admitting that such a call is itself religious. I've argued against the effectiveness of all the main efforts to address the divisiveness of religion in our world today. Yet I strongly sympathize with their purpose. Religion can certainly be one of the major threats to world peace. At the beginning of the chapter, I outlined the slippery slope that every religion tends to set up in the human heart. This slippery slope leads all too easily to oppression. However, within Christianity, robust Orthodox Christianity, there are rich resources that can make its followers agents for peace on earth. Christianity has within itself remarkable power to explain and expunge the divisive tendencies within the human heart. Christianity provides a firm basis for respecting people of other faiths. Jesus assumes that non-believers in the culture around them will gladly recognize much Christian behavior as good. That assumes some overlap between the Christian constellation of values and those of any particular culture and of any other religion. Why would this overlap exist? Christians believe that all human beings are made in the image of God, capable of goodness and wisdom. The biblical doctrine of the universal image of God, therefore, leads Christians to expect non-believers will be better than any of their mistaken beliefs could make them. The biblical doctrine of universal sinfulness also leads Christians to expect believers will be worse in practice than their orthodox beliefs should make them. So there will be plenty of ground for respectful cooperation. Christianity not only leads its members to believe people of other faiths have goodness and wisdom to offer, it also leads them to expect that many will live lives morally superior to their own. Most people in our culture believe that, if there is a God, we can relate to Him and go to heaven through leading a good life. Let's call this the moral improvement view. Christianity teaches the very opposite. In the Christian understanding, Jesus does not tell us how to live so we can merit salvation. Rather, He comes to forgive and save us through His life and death in our place. God's grace does not come to people who morally outperform others, but to those who admit their failure to perform and who acknowledge their need for a Savior. Christians, then, should expect to find non-believers who are much nicer, kinder, wiser, and better than they are. Why? Christian believers are not accepted by God because of their moral performance, virtue, or wisdom, but because of Christ's work on their behalf. Most religions and philosophies of life assume that one's spiritual status depends on your religious attainments. This naturally leads adherents to feel superior to those who don't believe and behave as they do. The Christian gospel, in any case, should not have that effect. It is common to say that fundamentalism leads to violence. Yet, as we have seen, all of us have fundamental, unprovable faith commitments that we think are superior to those of others. The real question, then, is, which fundamentals will lead their believers to be the most loving and receptive to those with whom they differ? Which set of unavoidably exclusive beliefs will lead us to humble, peace-loving behavior? One of the paradoxes of history is the relationship between the beliefs and practices of the early Christians as compared to those of the culture around them. The Greco-Roman world's religious views were open and seemingly tolerant. Everyone had his or her own God. The practices of the culture were quite brutal, however. The Greco-Roman world was highly stratified economically, with a huge distance between the rich and the poor. By contrast, Christians insisted that there was only one true God, the dying Savior, Jesus Christ. Their lives and practices were, however, remarkably welcoming to those that the culture marginalized. The early Christians mixed people from different races and classes in ways that seemed scandalous to those around them. The Greco-Roman world tended to despise the poor, but Christians gave generously not only to their own poor, but to those of other faiths. In broader society, women had very low status, being subjected to high levels of female infanticide, forced marriages, and a lack of economic equality. Christianity afforded women much greater security and equality than had previously existed in the ancient classical world. During the terrible urban plagues of the first two centuries, Christians cared for all of the sick and dying in the city, often at the cost of their lives. Why would such an exclusive belief system lead to behavior that was so open to others? It was because Christians had within their belief system the strongest possible resource for practicing sacrificial service, generosity, and peacemaking. At the very heart of their view of reality was a man who died for his enemies, praying for their forgiveness. Reflection on this could only lead to a radically different way of dealing with those who were different from them. It meant they could not act in violence and oppression toward their opponents. We cannot skip lightly over the fact that there have been injustices done by the church in the name of Christ. Yet who can deny that the force of Christians' most fundamental beliefs can be a powerful impetus for peacemaking in our troubled world? Chapter 2, How Could a Good God Allow Suffering? For many people, it is not the exclusivity of Christianity that poses the biggest problem. It is the presence of evil and suffering in the world. Some find unjust suffering to be a philosophical problem, calling into question the very existence of God. For others, it is an intensely personal issue. They don't care about the abstract question of whether God exists or not. They refuse to trust or believe in any God who allows history and life to proceed as it has. In December 2004, a massive tsunami killed more than 250,000 people around the rim of the Indian Ocean. Over the following weeks, newspapers and magazines were full of letters and articles asking, "Where was God?" One reporter wrote, "If God is God, he's not good. If God is good, he's not God. You can't have it both ways, especially after the Indian Ocean catastrophe." Despite the confident assertion of the columnist, the effort to demonstrate that evil disproves the existence of God is now acknowledged on almost all sides to be completely bankrupt. Why? Evil and suffering isn't evidence against God. Philosopher J.L. Mackey makes this case against God in his book, The Miracle of Theism. He states it this way: if a good and powerful God exists, he would not allow pointless evil, but because there is much unjustifiable pointless evil in the world, the traditional good and powerful God could not exist. Some other God or no God may exist, but not the traditional God. Many other philosophers have identified a major flaw in this reasoning. Tucked away within the assertion that the world is filled with pointless evil is a hidden premise, namely, that if evil appears pointless to me, then it must be pointless. This reasoning is, of course, fallacious. Just because you can't see or imagine a good reason why God might allow something to happen doesn't mean there can't be one. Again, we see lurking within supposedly hard-nosed skepticism an enormous faith in one's own cognitive faculties. If our minds can't plumb the depths of the universe for good answers to suffering, well then, there can't be any. This is blind faith of a high order. The fallacy at the heart of this argument has been illustrated by the no-see-ums illustration of Alvin Plantinga. If you look into your pup tent for a Saint Bernard and you don't see one, it is reasonable to assume that there is no Saint Bernard in your tent. But if you look into your pup tent for a no-see-um, an extremely small insect with a bite out of all proportion to its size, and you don't see any, it is not reasonable to assume they aren't there, because after all, no one can see them. Many assume that if there were good reasons for the existence of evil, they would be accessible to our minds, more like St. Bernard's than like no-see-ums. But why would that be the case? This argument against God doesn't hold up, not only to logic, but also to experience. As a pastor, I've often preached on the story of Joseph in Genesis. Joseph was an arrogant young man who was hated by his brothers. In their anger at him, they imprisoned him in a pit and sold him into a life of slavery and misery in Egypt. Doubtless Joseph prayed to God to help him escape, but no help was forthcoming, and into slavery he went. Though he experienced years of bondage and misery,